This is Mike Lee, and you are listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio. It's Thursday, April 4th, 2019. This is episode 547. It took me 547 episodes. Do you know how many hours of talking to people who I have no interest in talking to? That's not true. I'm just kidding around. But it is so many episodes to do just to lead up to a conversation with the brilliant, I don't use that word lightly. I really don't. But the brilliant genius. He's a genius. That word is bandied about left and right, north and south. It's abused. The term genius, the term brilliant, is abused. It's diluted. But if you were to reboot the term and start over, and you would say, let's begin listing contemporary genius filmmakers, Mike Lee would come up at the very fucking beginning. You know I don't curse a lot of my intros. I don't. But I'm making a point here. In 1991, I was in my late 20s, and I went for a walk in the village. I think I had just, maybe would just, I could be wrong. I was either living on the Upper West Side or I just bought my first apartment in the Gramercy area. But I was out and about. This is my mind's, you know, my memory. And I came across, I think it may have been the Quad Cinema. I don't know. If you're a New Yorker, you follow me. It doesn't really matter. It was an art house theater. And on the marquee and the posters that were hung outside. This is why I'm not sure it was the Quad. Maybe they still do that. It doesn't matter. I'm getting distracted. There was a poster of a film called Life is Sweet. And there was something about the poster and the title that attracted me on that particular day in 1991. And I bought a ticket all by myself. And I went in and I watched this movie. And like maybe, what was it, 5 or 6 years earlier when I had walked into a movie theater in Boston and I had accidentally bought a ticket for one movie and ended up walking into the wrong room because I misread the stub. And I accidentally sat down in the wrong room and the lights went down, or they were already down, actually. I think I just said, why am I late to this movie? In Boston, at this art house multiplex called the Nickelodeon, which isn't there anymore. But I sat down, and this movie went on, and it turned out to be Stranger Than Paradise. And then my life had changed. And then when I moved back to New York City after school, I went into a movie with my friend Rachel, and we went to see Spike Lee's She's Gotta Have It. And, you know, my life was changed. And we went back some time later and we saw Sex Lies in Video and my life was changed. You know, I went to see Simple Men and my life was changed. And I went to see Desperately Seeking Susan and my life was changed. And I went to see With Nell and I and my life was changed. And I could keep going. but the mid-80s into the early 90s was the most exciting time as a young man living in New York City and in Boston, I guess you could say, because that's also where I saw Spinal Tap. And it was also during this period when I saw so many other fantastic movies from all over the globe, but particularly from America and from the UK, with some exceptions. And then that day in 1991, I walked into a screening of Life is Sweet. And boy, was life sweet. Because I fell in love with this charming, funny, quirky movie with these actors. I had no idea who they were. But I fell in love with them. Who knew? Who knew when I was sitting in Life is Sweet as a young man that I was watching the performances of Alison Steadman and Jim Broadbent, Stephen Rea, Timothy Spall, and David Thewlis all in one movie? And that's not even the entire cast, you know, but those actors would continue to go on and become pretty much recognizable and household names in either the UK or at least, you know, or even on a broader stage in international art house cinema. Jim Broadbent, Stephen Rea, David Thewlis, Timothy Spall, Alison Steb, and my life was changed. I loved that movie. I went back and I saw it again. And then I knew who Mike Lee was, and he was in my head, and he would never go away. He was in my DNA. And a couple years later, this movie Naked came out, and I thought when I saw Life is Sweet that I had seen one of the great movies that this filmmaker, I didn't have any idea that I was just starting on this journey with this guy, but I saw Naked, and I went, and then I went back, and I brought my friends to see it, because I couldn't believe what I was watching. I couldn't believe how good this movie was. And I didn't even remember David Thewlis was in Life is Sweet. That's how blown away I was by this career-breaking, astounding, life-changing performance of David Thewlis. The film also, Naked, I'm talking about, starred Katrin Cartlidge, who also just captured my imagination. Her unique beauty and her incredible talent only made it more tragic and difficult to believe when she passed away at such a young age, you know? She was also in a small film called Before the Rain, and she was in Breaking the Waves, and also came back into Mike Lee's following film, Career Girls, and then she passed away at the very young age of 41. But, you know, I would keep going back over and over to see Mike Lee films as they've come out over the last 25 years or so, and I've never been disappointed. You know, they're not all going to be the best film I've seen, of course not, but you know, you go to Martin Scorsese movie, or you go to Steven Soderbergh movie, they can't all be the best. One's the best, and I'm not going to even suggest which one is my favorite of the Mike Lee films. There's a handful of them, so I don't know if Secrets and Lies or Career Girls, Vera Drake, not going in order anymore. Another Year, Happy-Go-Lucky, Topsy-Turvy. I'm just, you know, I'm riffing here. But they're all so spectacular. You know? I love them all. Mike Lee is magic. It's magic. So, I interviewed Mike Lee around the time of Happy-Go-Lucky, but it was for a written piece. And then I interviewed him again for Another Year, I don't remember those experiences very well because I don't think they stand out. I don't think I was that great. Even in this interview you're about to hear, I'm good. There's moments. He was in a spectacular mood. I was the first person he saw. The person following me was late or couldn't make it, so I had extra time. It was just all the planets aligned. And I was going to have this moment. And Mike Lee walked in with a big smile, and he was in a good mood because screenings were going well, and Q&As were going well. And he was traveling around the States, and things were going well for Mike with this new film called Peter Lou. And it's a period piece. It's dramatic. It's very epic. It's tragic. It's the biggest budget he's worked with. But it is not a contemporary situation, family situation works, you know, like the typical British thing he does. This is very different, and a lot of people may not like respond to it the way they did to Another Year or Happy Go Lucky or Naked or High Hopes or Bleak Moments or Meantime, Abigail's Dinner. I'm going back to these teleplays that he did for the BBC. These are available on a box set. Mike even reminded me that you can purchase everything. Everything that Mike Lee has made, pretty much, with hardly any exception, is available. There's a short that he made recently called A Running Jump. And I found it through my own means. Not saying I'm going to recommend how you go about finding this short, but see it. It stars Eddie Marsan, who was in Happy Go Lucky. And if you've seen Happy Go Lucky, you will know who Eddie Marsan is. You'll never forget him because you saw him in this brilliant performance that almost captures what David Thewlis captured as Johnny in Naked. Almost captured what Jane Harricks captured as Nicola in Life is Sweet. He's right up there with those performances in Happy Go Lucky. And then he became a big star. You see, Mike Lee has discovered in a countless number of or created careers. He'll never admit to it, but he has created careers for an unbelievable number of actors. These were maybe established local UK actors who did theater and small films, and then they were lucky enough to get into a Mike Lee film, and then they became stars. You're telling me before Naked, David Thewlis was in Life is Sweet. What else did he do that anybody knows him from? And then he became a huge international superstar from being in Harry Potter movies. Jim Broadbent. Of course he's known for years, but when he did Life is Sweet, that catapulted him. When Gary Oldman and Tim Roth were in Meantime, their careers took off, okay? When Sally Hawkins played Poppy in Happy Go Lucky, her career took off. Eddie Marsan was in the same movie, his career took off, and he's been on like 45 seasons of Ray Donovan and on and on. All right, this is one of the longest intros I've ever done because I have to tell you that there have been a handful of podcast interviews where I have to say to myself, I am sitting with this person. I can't believe it. And that I love this person. They changed my life at some point, and now I'm sitting across from them having a conversation. And it's amazing. So I've had that experience a number of times doing this podcast for these 547 episodes. And this is one of them. This is my conversation with Mike Lee on Film Wax Radio.
Good people give ear, Since times are so hard, my song to the poor, it doth pay some regard. For trade being dead, I'm weaving out a fall. But I hope in a few months, it will make amends for all.
We are on the brink of liberty.
We demand that our suffering cease.
Now is the time for action. Now!
The corrupt order will come crashing down!
Liberty or death! Liberty or death! Liberty or death!
I want to tell you that as a young, I guess a youngish man in New York City, you know how the memory has its own version of actually what happened as opposed to reality. I don't know. But in my memory, I was walking around the city and
Which city?
This one. And I came across the marquee said with a poster of Life is Sweet in 1990, I assume, or 91, whenever 91. It was here.
Yeah. 91.
I said, oh, this looks great. I'm going to go in and check it. I had nothing but time, of course, at that age. So I went in and I watched it, and I discovered you. You know, that was when that was probably your first, I'm guessing, film that was distributed properly.
No, it wasn't.
Properly here.
High hopes.
It was got some distribution here.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Really? Okay. My mistake.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you were very little.
Not so, but
okay.
I went back and watched it, but
yeah, where?
I mean, here.
Here?
Like in New York, for instance.
Oh,
All
over the show, really. I mean, no, it had a proper distribution.
Okay, good. Very good. Well, I remember just, Life is Sweet sort of took off. At least that began some America's love affair with Mike Lee, would you say? But it was Life is Sweet, which just caught on with people in a broader way, and then the distribution I assume got much easier.
Yes, I suppose Naked really moved it on, but then of course Secrets and Lies, and we got nominated. We had five nominations.
All right,
first Secrets.
Yeah, so it really is a process. Let's face it; it's true. I'm thinking of the art house, or you know, the crowd who discovers Life is Sweet. But yeah, Naked caught on in a bigger way and was in many theaters. I remember, and I just remember going to that several times and bringing friends. You know, it was that powerful, and then. I remember also, sorry, I'm going down memory lane a little bit, but meeting you the first time, I thought I would be cool and gain your, you know, trust and your friendship if I told you that I had seen all of your teleplays, which I had.
Yes.
I rented them on Netflix, and you looked, your face just sort of fell, and you goes, you know, in the UK, they've done a beautiful job restoring those, you know, but in the here, you know, you've gotten these bloody awful transfers, and I pissed you off. And I don't think I ever recovered that interview.
No, I'm sure you didn't, because it was. I mean, in fact, they were put out here, my telefilms, by a company called Waterbearer.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's right. And they were pirate edition. And we encouraged them to do it.
Okay.
Behind the BBC's back, because there was no money in it for us, nor for anybody. They were literally pirate. They were in the Upper East Side, operating out of an apartment. But the thing was, you could go into Kim's video store in St. Mark's Place, and you could find my films. They were on these terrible editions, but at least you could see them. That was the point. And that's why we illicitly encouraged them to put them out behind the BBC's back. Yeah. So, I mean, that's probably what I said, rather than, with all due respect to your memory, than castigating you for looking at them. Because they hadn't restored them at that time in the UK. That's a much more recent thing. You know, now there's a box set, and we did a whole restoration and commentaries and all the rest of it.
I see.
But they'd all sunk without trace. And that's one of the problems with BBC films, you know.
Yeah. I would love to get my hands on that box set, you know, if there was one in the...
Go online, you'll find it.
Yeah.
It's really straightforward. They're out there.
Very good.
Mike Lee at the BBC, it's called. Everything's on it. It's beautiful. Blue.
The box or the content?
The box, because the other one, the features, is red.
Okay. Is there a box of your features too? Going through what?
Up to
Happy Go Lucky.
No, more recent. No, before Happy Go Lucky. Up to Vera Drake.
Oh, okay.
We're hoping to do a new box set of all the films since Vera Drake.
Yeah. Well, you got to have a few more films to add to it, though. You got to get busier. Every 4 years is not cutting it.
Well, actually, you know what? Happy Go Lucky is actually 2009, so it's 10 years ago.
It is, I know. But Happy Go Lucky, you did another year. Was that after Happy Go Lucky?
Yeah, and Mr. Turner and Peter Lou.
So
that's another four films.
And you could, I don't know if legally what the ramifications are, but couldn't you also a Running Jump?
Oh, yes.
I saw that as well.
Yeah. Did you like it?
Yeah. In contrast to Peter Lou, it was like nobody would believe it's the same filmmaker if you were just discovering you through Peter Lou, and then they saw that.
Well,
be like,
we were having a joke, and we with Peter Lou,
clearly.
Whatever else we were doing, although there is humor in it, we weren't having a joke.
Oh, with Peter Lou?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're a little bit more hard-pressed to find the jokes.
There's humor.
Even the most, I would say, devastating moments, the... I guess you could say the massacre is there's nothing humorous remotely in that. But that scene, the montage, maybe you could say where the magistrates are interviewing those lower class.
Are sentencing them. They're
sentencing.
Not interviewing. They're sentencing
Excuse
them.
Me.
Yeah. they're sending them. They're giving them the most draconian punishments for the smallest of offenses. And those three scenes. Each of those was a dramatization of a real magistrate, and those were actual cases that those guys actually tried, and the punishments were the actual ones they gave. I haven't made any of that up. That was all for real.
Yeah.
Outrageous though it is.
Yet. And that's amazing information you just shared. But at the same time...
There's some humor
There's
in
some
it.
Weird... Yeah, just the naivete, the complete... you know, the actors, well, the characters they created, which I know are based on actual people, as you just said, but their innocence.
The magistrates are drawn from the actual magistrates that existed
Correct.
At the time.
Okay. And the crimes, but the victims themselves, or I should say the perpetrators, quote unquote, are made up, except that they're using
the actual.
Right, I understand. But it's their, in a way, their innocence at the same time, which is all the more... Which the contrast of what they've done and what they're undergoing is what almost makes it like it's almost too crazy to be.
Yes,
so you laugh almost. This
is
insane.
But humor, the words are similar, aren't they? Humor and humane. I mean, it's the same thing, really.
Yeah. I was trying to figure out the motivation for you to tell this particular story, other than we're coming on to the. In just a matter of weeks or months, the 200th anniversary of
the bicentenary is on August the 16th.
That's right.
That's one of the reasons for making the film.
Okay.
We just thought it would be opposite. But obviously, we felt an instinct that it would be a timely story to tell. What we didn't know is how right we were going to be, because we started planning it at the beginning of 2014. And what we didn't know was that... All kinds of things were going to kick off, like Trump, like Brexit, like the rise of the far right in various places, and other things that raise questions about democracy. Mm-hmm. And the film is, of course, about democracy. Our instinct was kind of right, really. Also, it's a story that ought to be told. I mean, I knew little or nothing about it when I was growing up a stone's throw from where it all happened in Manchester.
Mm-hmm.
And very few of us did. Although it was a big deal in the 19th century and it resonated through the labour movement and the rise of the unions and the fight for the vote, which went on for a century. And that's primarily what they were battling about at Peterloo.
Are you saying it wasn't in the history books when you were... Growing up in New York?
Hardly. But I read about it in, I don't remember when, probably the 70s, perhaps the early 80s, I just can't remember, I read a book. And I remember thinking, you know what, someone should do a film about this. And at that time, it would not have occurred to me for a split second that that somebody might be me, because I was, as I still am, committed to making films about the contemporary world. I hadn't got around to doing period films yet at that time. But anyway, it seemed, for all sorts of reasons, including the fact that I am a native Mancunian, i.e. from Manchester, and that also felt like a good reason to investigate.
Oh, that is. Yeah. So you were brought in Manchester, in the city?
In Salford, which is the twin city with Manchester.
Okay.
But literally, you could get to where it happened on the bus in about 15 minutes from where I, quarter of an hour from where I grew up.
Where did you shoot the
Not actual... one frame of it was shot in Manchester, because they built a great Victorian city after 1819, and now it's a great modern city.
I have been there, but it's been
There you go. It's got trams all over it and smart restaurants where it all happened. We shot it all over the place. The actual massacre was shot as far away from Manchester as you can get. We shot it at a place called Tilbury Fort, which is next to the docks at Tilbury, which is east of London, down on the estuary. And we took it over for a long time to build and shoot this event.
Was casting folks like, well, you used quite a number of very, very British workaday actors.
You mean working class when you say workaday?
Well, I mean, these are the actors you'll see. If you're British, you know who these actors are. They may not all be names in
well, there's a Rory.
Rory's relatively well known for
Rory
all his
Kinnear
work here.
And Maxine Peake are the best known actors in it.
Right,
and frankly, there's quite a lot of actors in it. There are some that I've worked with before, quite a few. There's a huge number that I haven't. But the main point is we've got an amazing resource of actors in the UK.
I know.
And, you know, somebody said to me the other day, here in the States, oh, presumably we had all these unknown actors because you couldn't afford the names. Which is, of course, preposterous, because actually the people that were in it, the people that were the right people for it, and boy, were they good. I mean, you know, I, as you know, like to work, can only work with what I call character actors, which is to say people that aren't narcissistic actors who play themselves, but people who are really good at playing real people out there in the street. And these guys...
That's what I meant by workaday, by the way.
Yeah. Practical, down to work... Earth, roll up your sleeves, do it.
Craftspeople, artisans.
Absolutely, and intelligent actors. I mean, they really have to be intelligent. And
but they're not YouTube stars. I don't understand why you would cast them.
I mean, the point is that they all got stuck into the research. They were all really committed to it. It was great, actually.
And you achieve a certain more of a verisimilitude... Because we're not noticing, oh my gosh, I wonder if they're going to be in the next Melissa McCarthy comedy. You know, it's just like,
well,
there's something that there's more documentary feel to something.
Yes, I would question that, but the main point is, no, I think what you mean is not so much documentary, it's that it's real. It feels like it's real.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Tim McInerney, who plays the Prince Regent, is probably the best known of all of those actors. Certainly to the British television audience.
Right.
But, you know, he was... you get him doing it because he's the right man for the job, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And he certainly delivers this extraordinarily overblown, self-indulgent, famously so, Prince Regent, you know.
Yeah. I don't doubt that for a moment you would have cast the same people if you were given a budget twice the size that you had to work with. However, it does probably play into reality of when you're spending a lot of money on, or a big part of your budget on, costumes and other, you know, location issues.
Look,
and,
it was a the biggest budget I've ever had, but it was a very, very small budget for what we achieved.
Right.
I mean, you talk about costumes. I mean, Jacqueline Duran, the costume designer, who's been nominated several times for... and won Oscars, I think, twice for other films. She is an absolute genius. She's not only brilliant at the accuracy of the costumes and brilliant at working with the actors and all the rest of it, but she is brilliant at making a pound stretch further than a pound would normally stretch. I mean, some of those military costumes actually she sourced in Italy. You know, I mean, she does the most extraordinary tricks to get the stuff on the screen. You know, and famously at Peterloo, the female reformers were all dressed in white. And she said, you know, it's actually more expensive to dress them in white than if we did them in an office. I said, no. They were in white. They should be in white. She said, yes, I agree. You're quite right. They were in white. No, I mean, you know.
Because you can't keep them remotely look like from scene to scene. It's almost impossible to keep them looking like they're not completely soiled and et cetera, and whatever their reason is. Explain when you said the women.
The female reformers.
The female reformers. Those were the wives and daughters and sisters.
No.
They weren't.
No. They were actual political activists in their own right.
Okay. Were they also going? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
The Manchester Female Reform Society. They came out because what they were fighting for was one man, one vote. They were not. There was a tiny minority of women who actually were onto the idea of universal suffrage, but that hadn't really happened at that time. Mm-hmm. It was all about, as is said, as one of them says in the film, it was about one vote per family.
I understand. So, that's what I was going to say to you right after that. You're making me feel like they're representing the family.
Well,
but you're saying that these were not necessarily...
They were fighting for the vote. I mean,
right,
what
okay,
they were...
For men. You know,
mm-hmm. At that time, only 2% of the population had the vote, and that 2% was landowners.
Landowners, yeah. Wealthy people.
Sure.
I just saw this Steve Bannon documentary. Have you guys... How could you?
I could have done, but I haven't. You know.
Yeah, I would recommend it because it deals with some of the parallels you were drawing earlier in terms of right-wing groups in Italy and in France, et cetera, these things that are happening here are also been going on in Europe at the same time. It's unfortunate, to say the least. But I was watching some of your older films just in preparation. I had some time. Originally, we were going to do this back in the fall or something, and then there was a decision to move the film's release date here in the United States to the spring. I was thinking about, to me, in a way, this is closest film to Meantime, almost, in the sense of just the feeling of being squashed by the economic and class burden that,
yes,
and you know, in a way, this is what's going on with the characters in Peterloo as well.
I think the difference is that in Meantime, they are kind of crushed by the...
Their souls, their spirits.
But the spirits are crushed. Although, you know, the what you could call the hero of the film, which is Mark, the elder brother, who you can see is going to get up and go. And
Tim Roth?
No, the other one, Phil Daniels.
Oh, okay.
Whereas this is a film about people being positive. Although you have, at the centre of the film, this working-class family, which I've obviously created, mm-hmm. which is not a direct portrait of people that actually existed, who are working through how they feel about the movement for political reform. But they, you know, in the end, it's about positivism, it's about hope, it's about, you know, proper aspirations for a decent life, you know.
See,
and fighting.
Peterloo.
Yeah. Peterloo, yeah.
Yeah, because it's interesting because it ends on such a bloody scene, you know?
Well, you know, that's what happened. And that's what makes you happy. And therefore, you know, what I don't do at the end of the film, I don't put a massive number of labels up that tell you what happened next and
right.
who got the vote and who went to prison and how many people were killed and all those questions that everybody wants to know. Mainly because, not least because you can go away and press buttons and find out on Wikipedia, but also the film ends in an emotional place. I take you to an emotional place, and I, as I always with my films, I don't actually say, think this. I hand it over to you to
right.
go away and meditate on, really.
So is Peterloo a polemical in the end?
Well, in the end, is it polemical?
No.
Well, no.
Yeah.
But it raises a huge number of questions for you to reflect upon and to debate and to argue about, if you like.
Especially because it does draw us accidentally or incidentally parallels to 2019.
Well, exactly. That's the thing. I mean, you know, people have said to me, OK, tell us what it tells us. Tell us what the message is. And I said, no. No, because actually it raises a whole lot of complex questions and issues, as I think probably, I hope my films do. Mm-hmm. It's not in the simplistic black and white sense didactic. But, of course, we are dealing with political issues. We're dealing with the right. nature of politics. So, you know, is it my most overtly political film to date? Of course it is. Mm-hmm. Is it more overtly political than the others? Well, it is. In fact, none of them actually are, this one. But on the other hand, are any of my previous films not political? And the answer is no. They're all mm-hmm. political. They're all about how we live and how we operate and how we treat each other and what life is about, really.
Yeah. While so many of your films deal with loneliness and alienation and the struggle for peace of mind and, you know, a lot of characters, there's always the Eddie Morrison character or David Thewlis or whomever are portraying those guys. But this one...
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say that. I think those are true. But on the other hand, of course, you know...
And in Life is Sweet as well. Nicola,
who's... That's true. But you have to see these characters in relation to the other characters. I mean, Life is Sweet is also a film about making the most of things and positivism in the family. And, of course, at the centre of Happy-Go-Lucky, you mentioned that fascist played by Eddie Marsan, the driving instructor. Mm-hmm. But, of course, at the centre of the film is an unquestionable, serious positivist, which is Poppy, which is Sally Hawkins' character, who is an idealist who really acts on it but also is, you know, people in some quarters have dismissed her as a sort of airhead, which she absolutely isn't. She's a very intelligent, motivated, mm-hmm. smart, and quite serious woman with a sense of humour. You know, I always see her. Although I didn't think about this till after I'd made Happy Go Lucky, but she's a kind of counterpart to Johnny in Naked. Mm. I mean, they're both people. Mm. When we made Naked, some people said, oh, well, no, he's a cynic. Not a cynic. He's a frustrated idealist. He's an idealist that is so frustrated with the material superficiality of the world.
He's very disappointed.
He's disappointed, and he turns in on himself, whereas Poppy is equally an idealist, but is, you know, engages with the world and deals with it.
But, you know, in different circumstances, she could become as simple. Johnny, she could be similar to Johnny if she gave up.
Well, I don't think,
know,
I think
or gave in.
I think that's hypothetical because
of course it is. Yeah,
I don't know.
I'm just saying.
I don't think that's. It's when I say it's hypothetical, I mean it's not mm-hmm. feasible mm-hmm. because that's not how she is. I mean, whatever her circumstances, she's one of those people that would deal with it, basically.
You don't think Johnny, in his earlier days,
well, had
yeah,
before
that's
not
the prequel.
That's not the same thing. Mm-hmm. Had Johnny had a decent education, which is to say, instead of sending him outside the classroom and punishing him, his teachers had seen that this was a bright kid and brought him out, he probably would have gone to university or done whatever. Yeah, that's true. But that doesn't mean the converse is true for Poppy.
That's true. You beat me, damn it. You beat me at my own game, trying to...
Ah, you have a game.
Well,
that in itself is a revelation.
So I've heard you say that Meantime was your favourite.
Well, I've got a soft... I don't know my favourite
film. Have you changed
that? I've got a soft spot for it. Not least because when we made it, for years and years, it had sunk without trace, and it only... survived in pirate copies.
And As you said before.
Well, I'd get letters from people saying, you know, I've seen this, I'm unemployed and I've been unemployed for years and I've seen this film and it's a real lifeline, you know, and so on. So I have a soft spot for it, but, you know, which is my favourite, I don't know. I mean, you could say I've got a soft spot for Topsy Turvy, mainly because it's in a kind of cuckoo in the nest, really. It's mm-hmm. completely unlike anything else. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, but if you saw, I think it would be interesting double feature to see Peter Lou and then Meantime, because you could see it's like fast forwards you to the sort of the byproduct, if you will, of what came out of England at that time.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And indeed, actually, you're also right, because Meantime was completely motivated by what Thatcher and Thatcher's government were doing. We were 4 years into Thatcher's regime at that time, and they were doing all these bullshit schemes to make it appear that they were dealing with unemployment, which they weren't at all, really. And in a way, there's a kind of satire on those schemes in Meantime when their aunt creates this job for Colin to come and decorate her house, you know.
Interesting, yeah. I thought you were going to see in Peterloo one of the... I keep referring to them as politicians, I guess, meekly suggests maybe if they get one, if we give the people one more pound or quid, what was the amount he wanted to give them, just so they wouldn't starve quite so much.
One of the magistrates.
Of the magistrates said, yes. Right? And that was immediately, of course, overruled. I mean, they're not going to give them an inch. But in a sense that there's that, as you know, Peterloo, which by the way got to you spent a little time at the very end also explaining that where the name came from, and that
it's a nickname invented by a journalist because you know it
had
was
to
just
sell papers.
Well, it was a, yeah. Well, I think it was less cynical than that, to be honest. I think it was just
shorthand,
like the Battle of Waterloo, really, mm-hmm. And it was a battle. It wasn't, because it isn't
was
a battle.
It? It's not a battle. It was a battle. At least starts with some level.
I agree. No, right? Absolutely. Balance. Of... That's why they called it that. But right. No, it wasn't. It's not a battle. It's it was chaos, actually. People were killed, of course.
Right. It was a massacre. I mean, it was a massacre. They closed off all right. They closed off the plaza, and then they just
Peterloo massacre. The word came from Waterloo on St. Peter's Field, which is the part of Manchester where it happened.
Yeah, and it's opening here in New York City. Oh, it's been, it already came, it came out in the UK, I imagine, last...
In the autumn, yeah.
Last autumn. How'd that go?
Good.
Yeah?
It was good, yeah.
Yeah?
Tragically, although it's just had a very successful release in Italy, and it's about to open in Spain, it's not been sold to France or Germany, which I think is a great tragedy, really.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, but nobody's picked it up in France, and it is very disappointing, really.
Mm. Well, if you're listening, and there are listeners, shockingly, in France and Germany, start to write your local...
Yes, no, do. I think it would be very helpful.
Whomever you would, who would you write in this case?
You do that, comrades. Yeah.
And but it's opening, let's see, today is the 3rd of April? April 3rd, April, I think?
It opens this weekend.
Yeah, so I just want to make sure. It is. So it opens here on April 5th in New York, and...
And
I urge people to go. And so many of your films are so available. If you haven't seen all of Michael Lee's films, they're all on various shades of fantastic.
How do you get on with Career Girls?
I love that film. It made me cry.
Yeah, good, because Katherine Cartlidge, who was in Naked, who died.
Of course,
sadly,
she
at the died.
Yes, she died very young.
She did, which is a great tragedy.
It is.
But I mention it because if I don't mention it, nobody ever does. Because for some reason, everyone seems to forget about that film. But I've got, apart from the fact, it's one of Katrin's two films that I made with her. She was great, and it is. I'm very fond of it, really. Mm-hmm. And it was a sort of thing that we did very quickly on the back of Secrets and Lies.
That's right.
And that may
That's
be why...
That's the one I was thinking of for some reason. Yeah. It, when you mentioned Career Girls, my mind went to Secrets right. and Lies.
But anyway, I'm glad you like it because
yeah.
it's, you know...
Yeah, no, I haven't seen it since it came out. But mind you, again, since Life is Sweet, I went to see all your films in the theater.
I also, if you ask me which you're not, which I'm... In one sense, most proud of in terms of the work we all did and the resonance of the film, it would probably be Vera Drake, because that was quite an achievement on everybody's part that contributed to it, really.
Mm-hmm.
And a tough film to make because it is a period film.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's blessed with the most extraordinary acting, of course. But it's got a great... all the work on it, from the cinematography to everything else. I'm very pleased with that film, mm-hmm. I must say.
Mm. And you've worked consistently with Dick Pope on all these films.
Ever since Life is Sweet in 1990. I haven't worked with any other cinematographer. And we have a very brilliant relationship. We have got a very a compulsive habit of pushing our own boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, making the decision to make a film about the great painter J.M.W. Turner
mm-hmm.
Was obviously a huge cinematic challenge, you know, and we immersed ourselves mm-hmm. in Turner's work for a number of years, you know, and the look of Turner is there in the movie.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, the look of Peter Lou is fantastic. I mean, he's done an amazing job, really.
Yeah, no, he's incredible, and he's been really recognized internationally, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Another contributor to my films who will maybe get overlooked but shouldn't is
mm-hmm.
John Gregory, who's the editor. He got nominated for three billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri a couple of years ago.
Oh,
yeah,
wow. Okay.
Yeah, for the Academy Award. He is an absolutely brilliant editor. And, of course, although the cut of the film is the responsibility of the director, and I'm no exception, of course, you do need to have a brilliant editor. And when it mm-hmm. comes to Peter Lou, when it comes to that great massacre sequence, for which we shot a massive amount of footage, of all, sometimes using three cameras,
mm-hmm.
You know, he was just brilliant at sorting it out and really making it work according to my general instructions, you know. I mean, you have to have an editor of that brilliance to make it as good as it is, really.
What would be amidst those instructions that you would have or part of the conversation you would have with him regarding specifically the massacre itself, which is the penultimate scene, and it's extended.
Well,
I mean, this is not something which is just like a minute or two. This is... No, how many minutes is that massacre?
It's quite long.
It is, yeah.
And it took us 5 weeks to shoot. So, I mean, yeah, we didn't talk about my instructions. I mean, first of all, the material is all there and the story has to be told. So obviously there's guidance from me on that. I mean, this is regular film director stuff. It's not just this is how film directors work.
Mm-hmm.
If they are responsible for the material, if they're mm-hmm. on the case, you know, which not all directors perhaps are. But it's down to details, you know. It's down to the precise order in which things happened and the precise weight of one thing against another, and you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, and those are the things that where the editor needs the freedom to play about with the details of the footage, but the director needs to keep an eye on the structure and the movement of the thing and the rhythm of the thing.
How did you meet him?
Oh, John, he cut... I met him in the BBC years ago when he was not cutting my films, but he was in the next door cutting room cutting somebody else's film.
I see.
He cut High Hopes and everything.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he cut Life is Sweet and Naked and mm-hmm. Secrets and Lies.
All the greatest hits.
And then there was a gap because he was doing other things, and then he came back and did the mm-hmm. last few films.
Mm. And how did you meet Pope?
Dick Pope?
Yeah.
I worked with a great cinematographer called Roger Pratt, who's gone on to make all kinds of Hollywood films.
Yeah.
But Roger had been a clapper loader originally
mm-hmm.
on the Monty Python films. So he knew Terry Gilliam. And when Terry Gilliam started to do features, he developed his relationship. And Roger couldn't shoot... He shot Mean Time and High Hopes, but then was supposed to shoot my next film, which was going to be what turned out to be Life is Sweet. But he was going to do The Fisher King with mm-hmm. Terry Gilliam, and he wasn't available. And somebody had said to me, you know, if Roger's not around, you should meet this guy, Dick Pope. He's a documentary film cameraman, cinematographer, and he's only done one little Welsh language television feature, but he'd be great.
Mm-hmm.
So I met him, and we clicked, and he did Life is Sweet, and the rest is history. And there you go.
So who was the cinematographer you worked with initially?
Roger Pratt.
Roger Pratt, that's who it was, okay. Well, I have been following these films so closely, you know, over the years.
that I felt like I feel like you get to know somebody, you know, who's making these films. What is your relationship with audiences, in, especially like in the UK?
With what?
With your audiences in the UK. I mean, what is, are you able to sort of live normal life, or are you?
Oh, no, I live a very normal life. Well, I mean, insofar as anyone lives a normal life, you know, I mean.
Do you, people constantly recognize
you
in the UK?
Yeah, they do, they do. And that's cool, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, they do in the street and in the supermarket.
You don't mind that?
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. No, not at all. But with very rare exceptions, they are nothing but enthusiastic, and they say, "I love your films." And it, almost invariably, I'm surprised, and I think, "How do they know it's me?" But of course, they do. And there you go. No. I mean, just occasionally. Mm-hmm. I mean, I came out of my apartment, which is right in central London, actually, mm-hmm. and I crossed the road, and a young black guy came mm-hmm. up to me and said, "You are a," used a word I can't use in your program. He said, "Your films are disgusting." He said, "They're an insult to humanity." And he threw a terrible fit and stomped off down the street. I don't know what his problem was, but he certainly wasn't a fan. But that's well, that's the rare exception.
Yeah, I imagine it is. And maybe he got the wrong guy. Maybe
No, he knew who I was. No question about that.
Oh, interesting.
He was more specific than I've just summarized.
What do you think people...
Well, I don't know. But the other thing that happens, which is far more interesting and certainly much funnier,
yeah,
is that, you know, things happen like I came out of the underground and a woman ran after me and said, "I have to say, I love your film about the Spanish Civil War." Mm-hmm. And or somebody else says, "Kes, I love Kes. It's my favorite."
Oh, sure.
And Ken Loach gets the same thing. They think he's me. And what's weird is that we don't make the same kind of films and that we don't look like each other at all.
Right.
But people still somehow put us together and mix us up.
Right. I would say his last... What was it called again?
Daniel Blake.
Daniel Blake might be, in a way, his closest Mike Leigh film.
I think that's pushing it, really.
Yeah, well, it's obviously different style, but a tone. But
well, anyway, that in the context of what you were asking me about.
Yes,
that
yes.
is an amusing.
So
thing
Ken Loach, and he's a bit older too.
He certainly sure. is.
You're young man compared. He keeps threatening to retire.
I know.
Good that he breaks his own promises.
Right? Sure.
Yeah. And do you keep up in the cinema here?
Oh, yeah.
And also in the U.S.? I mean, when it comes to the Oscar contenders or stuff, does that matter to you?
Films are films.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. Films are films. I mean, you know, there are some films, much hyped films, that I find it harder to work up particular enthusiasm to see. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I saw pretty much all the... Well, I'm an Academy member, apart from anything else.
Right.
And when the London Film Festival happens in the autumn every year, I get a free pass, and I just clear my diary. I
really?
Just watch movies all day, you know.
Really?
I want to see movies, you know. I think, uh-huh. you know, people say, oh, it's surprising for a filmmaker. You know, novelists that don't read books or painters that don't look at art would seem to me an anomaly, really. It seems a very natural thing for a film director to want to watch movies, and I do.
Sure.
But, you know, films is not Hollywood. Films is world cinema. And
correct.
That's important,
right.
you know.
Yeah, yeah. I think, Fellini.
Well, I know Fellini, that's for sure.
But I guess...
Let's be clear what I mean. I mean, there are, you know, of course, classic world cinema, which is what you mean when you say Fellini,
that's right.
is one thing and very important. But I mean contemporary, continuing, fresh world cinema.
Right.
Because there's all kinds of movies being made in places where they haven't even previously made movies.
That's right.
Which are really, really exciting and fresh and original and not hidebound by Hollywood precepts of what a movie should be.
That's right. And the festivals are really the best places to go to see them because, first of all, a lot of them don't get distributed, at least very broadly.
You say they're the best, in a way, festivals are very often the only way to get to see those.
Yes, that's right.
But the good news is, this is why actually DVD and hopefully streaming mm-hmm. are good news, that is a way of accessing material that we may not otherwise have an opportunity to see.
And there are a couple of streaming services that actually do focus on... let's say, I'm using these words, they're not used by obscure international cinema.
Sure.
You know, whether it's some Iranian film that maybe...
What I call world cinema.
Yeah, yeah. You're absolutely right. But people should go to the, if you're, you know, festivals. I mean, there's obviously international festivals, and then there's more, let's say, American, like we have here, tons. Every neighborhood has a film festival, and they're much more local and domestic and all that. But so interesting. But do you get to go to, do you go to Cannes unless you, if you don't have a film?
No, I wouldn't dream of going to Cannes if I didn't have to.
Right.
Cannes is a horrible experience. But if you've got a film in competition,
right.
And I've been a number of times, always, with a film in competition, that's the mm-hmm. that's a reason for being there. Oh, I was once on the jury, and mm-hmm. that was another reason for being there.
Sure.
I wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
Apart from anything else, I wouldn't go unless somebody was paying, because it's a very, very expensive.
That's true.
But
too.
Also, it's a kind of chaotic circus, you know.
Mm-hmm. Will there be, as we do wind it down, will there be a? Are you working on another story? I guess this is the most typical question, but I as a fan, you know, I do want to...
You want the answer to your question?
I can yammer
get
on
get to the
for
end
hours.
Of the question and I'll answer it.
Thank you for putting me in my place.
No, that's all right. I can see what you're asking me.
I know, it's just terrible. But yeah. I'm not good at QA. I'm good at conversations, less so at QA,
yes.
Formal.
Well, even that's open to some debate. The point is that until I have the money for another film, I refuse to contemplate exactly what it will be, because mm-hmm. it will be determined, given the way I make films,
yep.
It will be determined by the size of the budget. And so I'm waiting for money. I've been waiting for nearly a year for money. It has not been forthcoming for a year. But hopefully, as and whenever money does materialise, I will then roll up my sleeves and make a film. And until that time, I can't tell you anything. And even if I knew exactly what it was, I still wouldn't tell you, because you'd have to wait and see.
Fair enough.
Okay.
That's it. I'm liberating you. Can you just say one thing?
Yes.
This is where you're just performing for me. Just... All you have to do is say, like, this is Mike Lee and you're listening to my show. Can you do that? Do you mind?
You write it down.
Okay.
Don't write it down, though. This is Mike Lee. Better.
No, I got that part. And you can say it in any way you want to, essentially.
Sure,
I'm just going to stick this in the show. You know, it's...
What does that say? Film Wax.
That's right.
Film Wax Radio.
That's right.
Why is it called Film Wax Radio?
No reason.
You see, the reason I ask the question is because people have been asking me lately, how do you feel about Netflix and streaming and all the rest of it?
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, you know, it's progress. I say, well, you know, I listen to a lot of music in my apartment, and I don't listen to it on wax cylinders, because they went out, dried out about 1910. And I'm forced to listen to them on CDs, listen to music on CDs, because that's the mode. And even now, that is becoming obsolete. So that's why I asked you why it's called Film Wax. Nothing to do with wax cylinders.
No, mostly, no.
Okay,
but
well, anyway.
Mostly to do with waxing.
Anyway, this is Mike Lee, and you are listening to Film Wax Radio.
You can subscribe to Film Wax Radio on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Spotify, Google Play. You can subscribe to it also on YouTube. I had a friend ask me recently, why do you put your podcast on YouTube? I don't put the podcast technically on YouTube. I put the segments of each conversation on YouTube.
And then people can listen to them individually, or they can listen to the playlist that I put together. So that's why I do that. So please go check out our YouTube channel. There's lots of great stuff on there. Please go check out our Facebook page. We're on Instagram and Twitter as well. We're starting a brand new platform. I don't know if you're who's listening at this stage in this episode, but I'm announcing it here on episode 547 on the outro. And that is that Filmwax TV is going to be a thing. And we taped it. It's got to be edited, but it'll be up online soon. I'll put it on YouTube. It is, and I'll put it on Facebook and everything. My first guest in this pilot episode is my friend and longtime friend of this podcast, of course, Orner Tukel. Of course, I put on a friend on my first show and somebody who I love and who is just great, great talker. Orner will be on episode one of Filmwax TV. And I'll have more to say about that in the coming episode or two. But later this month, in April, we will have the first episode up. And I see it like a once a month type of thing, but I'm not positive yet. But I kind of do. I sent Hal Hartley an invitation. No pressure. But the idea is to, you know, bring on friends of the podcast who, and then bring on, you know, wouldn't it be great to get somebody like Steve Buscemi on? Wouldn't it be great to get somebody like, I don't know, Steve McQueen on this show, or Spike Lee, or, I don't know, Jim Jarmusch? Wouldn't it be great if next time Allison Anders is in town, that she comes on and does Filmwax TV and Filmwax Radio as well? So keep your ears peeled, because very shortly you will be able to watch Filmwax TV, and you'll see my ugly mug. I want to thank everybody for listening to this episode. We have coming up in the next couple of episodes, Giancarlo Esposito, finally. It will be up shortly with a new film. It's a musical, but it's a movie. It's called Stuck, and I've been wanting to post this for a year or more. Giancarlo Esposito, the great character actor, and I mean Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul. Come on, this guy is incredible. And finally, we'll get the conversations, hours of conversations with the film historian and author Joseph McBride. We're going to talk about Ernst Lubitsch, John Ford, Orson Welles, Howard Hawks, Steven Spielberg, and others. And then my conversation with Paul Lazar will be coming up. And Sam Green is a great filmmaker as well. And we'll have that conversation up shortly. And then my friend Robert Longstreet, we have an episode. A lot of guys, I'm sorry. We're men, white male heavy here for a few episodes. And the great veteran actor Stuart Margolin will be up as well shortly. And we're working on tons more, so there's a lot of exciting, I can't announce them yet, but there's a lot of great and exciting filmmakers and actors coming up on the show. And we're going into a heavy-duty rotation of film festivals, too, so just in the coming weeks, we'll have dispatches from Montclair Film Festival, Tribeca Film Festival, the Maryland Film Festival, BAM Cinema Fest, of course. The Lighthouse International Film Festival, on which I will be serving as a juror. And I hope we're trying to plan to get to the Nantucket Film Festival also this spring, later this spring, early summer. I'm sure I left out a few others. But getting into the busy time. Thank you for listening. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio. Take care of yourselves in the month.
Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols.